Ladies and gentlemen, get ready to embark on a journey like no other. Welcome to the Glum Lot Podcast,
your go-to destination for a unique blend of recovery and discovery.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Mark. And in this podcast, we will endeavor to create a safe and uplifting space for our guests and listeners to share their stories with sincerity and a touch of humor.
Remember, we are not a glum lot. The Glum Lot Podcast is more than just a source of entertainment. It's a beacon of hope, proving that even in the darkest moments, recovery is possible. Every story we share carries the power to inspire positive change.
So buckle up, get ready to listen, and join us in discovering the strength that lies within every individual's journey. This is the Glum Lot Podcast, where humor meets hope. Welcome to episode number 24 of the Glum Lot Podcast. Brett.
Hi.
And I am Mark. And of course, you know, we have listeners all over the globe at this point, which is kind of cool.
Oh, it's beyond cool.
Some of the countries we have downloads in are Ireland, Germany,
Australia,
the Philippines.
Now. Yeah, the Philippines.
India.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's pretty
good stuff. Good stuff. Hey, if you're a listener in a country other than the U.S.,
yes,
other than the U.S.,
give
us an email at theglumlotpodcast@gmail.com and let us know where you are and your thoughts on the program. We'd love to hear from you. We want to find out what's going on with people in other countries. We know that AA is worldwide and, sobriety, and we also know that addiction is a problem in every corner of the world, so... We want to shine a little light, man. That's
shine
all.
Shine a little light on me.
That's right. And in that, in the interest of that, Brett, what do you got for a little tidbit?
Are you seeking light, Mark?
I'm always seeking light.
Excellent, excellent. You know. Me as well.
Yeah.
If you catch on to that, let us know in email as well.
Right.
But anyways.
Look to the east.
Yes, always heading east. But, you know, one thing I always experienced in life and growing up is my upbringing is putting everybody else's needs in front of yours.
That's funny because my upbringing is putting my needs in front of everyone else's.
Well, yeah, and they're both can be detrimental, right?
That's right. You need balance.
Yeah.
You need some perspective, right?
And I really, you know, I didn't realize how bad it was for me until I became sober.
Mm.
And what I noticed was I was thinking, oh, I've got to give everybody rides. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. I've got to be home for my kids every waking minute. I've got to be making sure that I'm making my wife happy, making this person happy, doing this, doing that. Ah!
Right. You're just trying to put out fires all over the place.
Right. And what's my – and I'll talk about my counselor all day long, the one that basically just stared me in the face within 10 minutes that I was an alcoholic when I hadn't even said anything, but –
you smelled like one, probably.
Could be. You know, there's truth to that. But what she said was, whatever you put in front of your sobriety, that's the first thing you're going to lose.
When you put things in front of your sobriety, before your sobriety, and your sobriety becomes not your primary purpose anymore, you are apt to lose that.
Yeah.
And what happens, what I've seen before in sobriety is people put a relationship before their sobriety. So they'll start skipping out of meetings, they'll drop the program, they'll put their whole life into this relationship. And sooner or later, the thing unravels and then they're in deep shit.
And me, you know how hard that was to hear? I've got three kids.
Yeah.
Right?
I've got six.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've got four cats.
Well, you got me beat on the cat front.
But anyways, you know, that was hard to hear. Like, I have to now ignore my family. Not ignore them, but for the most part, I need to spend more time on me. And this is a selfish program.
And you know what? You're not ignoring your family. What you're really doing is you're taking care of your disease so you don't ignore your
family. And so I have a much better life
right,
with my family.
When we drink, we put the drink first. We ignore everything else.
Oh, yeah.
At the expense of everything to drink.
Yeah.
And so to do a little bit of extra sobriety work, spend some time on that, it pays off for everyone in your life.
Yes.
And we know that.
Yeah.
You become a better father, a better employee, a better husband, you know what I mean? A better wife, whatever. You become a better person.
But it's so hard to see that at
it
first.
It is. And, you know... nobody in my life has ever said, geez, do you really need to go to another meeting?
Right.
Nobody said that to me.
That's true.
Yeah.
Damn.
Do you? And, you know, part of it is, I mean, other people don't want us around 24/7
no.
either.
Mm-mm.
You know, especially
new.
Especially if we're dealing with untreated ism,
oh,
right?
Boy.
They're like, please go to a meeting. In fact, I've heard people say that at meetings a lot of times. My wife told me I needed a meeting.
Yeah.
So they know. They can tell when you're, you know, getting squirrely.
And the ones that have been around a while, they're actually grateful for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I mean, the payoff is huge for everyone in your life. So, with that in mind, our guest. Our next guest is a person who is kind of breaking out through new frontiers.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Yep. I met this guy on, I saw a post on LinkedIn. It's mm-hmm. a professional networking thing, if you haven't heard of it. And I saw he was doing this fundraising event. It was a walk.
Yeah.
And I won't get into this too much, but this is a person that neither one of us knows. Not
right.
at all.
Yep.
And I saw this thing that he's going to be doing, and it's basically having a sober community, right? And it's a building space, and you can go there and get better physically as well.
So like a gym,
workout
facility.
And the only requirement to go there is to be sober for 48 hours, and it's free.
Wow.
I mean, what an aspiration, and what a place for all of us to come together and maybe work on that side.
And, you know, that part of self-care for me is important.
Mm-hmm.
Physically active and fit for me is huge. It's a big part of my sobriety.
Good. I need to learn some of it.
You know, and if you want to, you certainly can. And, you know, maybe this will give you an opportunity. But there are those of us in the program all over the world who like to create things. Like I've started a group before.
Yeah.
I started a sober band. We started this podcast.
That's right.
And so, you know, it's interesting. I like creating things.
Yeah.
And I think this guy's going to fall right into that ilk. Let's wait no further to bring him out.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So let's welcome Henry.
Henry! Welcome to the podcast, Henry.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Glad to have you here. Can we start with your sobriety date?
It was almost 32 years ago at the end of October. So when did I make it? Last week of October 32.
Oh,
so 1992.
October 32nd.
Yeah, there you go.
Right? That's about when I put it because honestly, I can't remember that week. It's kind of blurry.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So let's go back to the start and your introduction to alcohol. What was that like?
All right. Well, my grandfather was a recovering alcoholic, and I never knew that until I was like in my teens. My father was an active alcoholic, and so I grew up in that environment, if you will. You know, I went Saturday mornings to bars and hung out there till like 1-2 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 o'clock, whenever my parents got done drinking for the day. And I came home, and I didn't know till years after, like 5-6 years after I got sober, that wasn't a typical childhood.
Mm.
And so I, you know, that's the way I grew up. It's what I was around. So as I got older, and my sister and I counted one time, and we had lived in 17 different houses by the time I was 11 years old.
Wow.
And
did you stay in the same school district?
Oh, no.
Oh, you guys bounced all.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was born in Florida, lived in Georgia, moved up here, lived in, I think like 14 of the houses, 13 of the houses were in the Syracuse area.
Hmm.
So I went to every single school district
you knew
Syracuse.
A lot of people.
I did.
A little bit.
I do. A little bit, yeah. Never was good at sports because I could never, you know, stay on a team
could
long
never
enough.
Finish. You know, I know what you're talking about. When I grew up, and, you know, we're pretty close probably to the same age, it was a different world in that drinking was so very accepted by middle class.
Right.
By the middle class, that drinking on a daily basis as a dad, you went to work, you drank, and that's how you were a man.
Yeah,
and it wasn't. I didn't see that as abnormal at all until I got older, and I was like, "That's not how I grew up."
Yeah,
my father was just drank. He never participated in my life. What are you, your father's a coach? What's going on here? My dad was never a coach of anything.
Yeah, right?
You know, so you start to discover these things. Okay, so your first exposure personally to alcohol consumption was?
I was in middle school, and we had a dance, and I think it was eighth grade, and there was a park near our house, and I went up to the park, and, you know, this was the days, and they probably still do it. We took every bottle of alcohol that was in the parents' cabinet, and we poured it in a mayonnaise jar, and I went on up, and I thought it would be cool to drink the whole thing.
And what did you guys call it?
You know, I don't.
We
I don't
called
remember.
It. We used to call it Around the World.
Around the World.
Because everything.
Yeah, from
And you know what's funny? My folks, my first exposure to Around the World, as we called it, was around the same time, the same age you were. And it was an overnight. This kid's house we were staying at, we're staying on a second floor. His bedroom was on the second floor. My best friend was there, and he had didn't have a lot of experience drinking, and we did Around the World. But this guy was very enthusiastic about drinking this. It ended up by the end of the night. Well, by the next morning, he was out the window. He had puked down the side of the house, and he had shit his pants.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the parents were just like, they got up and they were mortified.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it sounds just like mine. My best friend was sleeping over.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had, at the time, Tijuana Smalls, these little tiny cigars were great. Yep, you know, we were doing that. So we went to the dance. And, of course, I was hammered by the time I got there. And, you know, during the dance, I had to go to the bathroom. So I went into the little boy's room, and I must have been, like, weaving back and forth in front of the urinal. And at the time, the janitor came in, and he said, son, are you all right? And I said, yeah, if you could stop this from moving. And he didn't think that that was too funny, so he went and got the vice principal and drove me home. And I remember the vice principal got in front of my house, and my best friend was sleeping over, and he drove up and he said, are your parents inside your house? I said, no, they're out at drinking. So he just let me go, and I guess, you know, I got sick in my bed. My friend came home, and he was sleeping on the floor, and then my parents came home. My mother, you know, smelled something, ran upstairs, and knew exactly what had happened, and she was like, come down here. You're going to, you know, drink everything we have, and you think it's funny to be drinking this stuff,
boy.
And blah, blah, blah. And my stepfather, who was 14 years in the Marine Corps, said, the hell with that. We're not going to waste good booze on him, and made me just sleep it off upstairs, and they were really irritated the next day when I didn't have a hangover.
No hangover. What kind of a drunk are you?
I know it.
Now that was the end of the story, right?
Right. Yeah.
So
that
that's
was
your first
that
experience.
Was started. And actually, my first drink. From what I understand, I don't remember it, but I guess my parents were having a party when we lived in Georgia, and I went on up. My mother reached for her beer that she had, and I was a toddler, and I'd taken a beer apparently upstairs, and by the time she found me, the bottle of beer was gone. But I don't remember.
You win.
Destiny
he wins
was written.
For the youngest.
Yeah. So far, you win.
Yeah, you win. Yep. Nice.
What are we, episode 24? Okay, yeah. So 24 is the leader so far. All right, so you had that experience at that middle school dance. Anything happened as you were coming up through high school with alcohol?
Yeah, you know, it was the time of marijuana and pot and everybody. I mean, our teachers were smoking. I know this one teacher used to take a couple of kids out back, and they used to smoke at the time.
Oh, my
and,
God.
It
You'd
was,
be
you
hung
know,
for that.
Yeah, you know, it would. You know, it was the 70s.
Yeah.
So we got but, you know, the pot wasn't the same as it is now.
Right.
You know, it was
oh,
a lot
God,
different.
No. Yeah.
And did that. Got into college. The biggest, I started smoking more pot, doing cocaine, all of that stuff. My roommates ended up being some of the biggest dealers on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always got my stuff for free. But I had a moral code. I wouldn't sell it. Right.
Oh, which is, yeah.
Yeah, very moral.
Well, you know, a guy's got to have his moral.
Yeah, you got to have your line, man.
Yeah.
Oh, you got your line, I'm sure.
What kind of a guy do you think I am?
He got his line.
Sell it. I'll do it all myself.
Yeah.
So
I'm not an animal.
Yeah, it's hilarious. So, you know, best friend actually ended up being my roommate in school, and he got nervous and called another friend of mine, and she showed up at college saying, you know, you're doing too much here, and I didn't get it.
You mean he got nervous about your
partying? He got
nervous
about my partying.
Mm.
And
so you were pretty much off the chain, though. Is that the idea?
It must have been at the time.
Yeah.
Man,
yeah.
I thought it was fine.
Yeah.
Every time I hear my story, it's crazy because I remember I got really close. I was not friends with this person, but we got really close. And all of a sudden, he just went away. And I found out years later why. The same thing. Oh, it's crazy.
Yeah, my high school friends, one by one, kind of dropped off, including this guy, you know, very good friends. And just kind of like one by one went away, and I didn't even notice.
No, hell
you
no.
know, and it was weird. So, you know, kept going, met my first wife. She had a great car. That's why I started dating her.
Excellent.
And it was a, was it 77 Trans Am?
Something
like that. It was nice. So, and, but, you know, I was still a jerk. And I was, you know, I was a womanizer. It just, it didn't work. We had our first, we had our son, Devin, and she had her issues too. So we ended up, but when he was a baby, we split up and got divorced. And then I was just, you know, trying to find myself for a number of years after that, trying to raise a son on the weekends.
Are you a daily drinker at this point?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like I would go to work, and I worked downtown, and there was several bars right around downtown. So I would leave work and go to the bars because I didn't want to go home and be alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, deal
with life.
Yeah, because I didn't like my company.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to be alone in my own head.
Yeah.
No, so, I know the feeling.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and so I would just, you know, drink, you know, all night long until, you know, 11, 12 o'clock at night, and go home. I go to bed, wake up, and do it all over again, you know, go to work the next day. The most embarrassing moment I ever had is when, you know, I got up, took a shower, went into work, and my boss called me inside and said, "Have you been drinking?"
Whoops.
I said, "Well, yeah, you know, yesterday I went on out." He goes, "No, you reek of alcohol now." And that was a slap in the face.
They're like, "Well, it is oozing out of my pores."
Yeah, and I didn't get
smell
it.
Vodka.
It's exactly what it was.
I sweat vodka.
So, you know, and I should have figured it out then, but of course I didn't.
Hell no.
You know, so, you know, dated a couple more people, met my wife, my present wife. Very, very lucky to meet her. I aspire to be half the person she is. Mm. She's just an amazing person. And she put me in my place right away. But not enough. You know, we got married. We had a daughter. So now I had son by my first marriage, and my daughter. And I was out in between jobs and, you know, taking photographs out of the side of a plane, sticking my head out, you know, put one of those hats on like Charlie Brown,
mm-hmm.
and stick my head out with a 35 millimeter
like
camera and
taking farms
pictures
and stuff?
Of exactly
yeah,
taking
yeah,
pictures
yeah, yeah, yeah.
of people's farms and then selling them. And the guy that flew the plane was just as bad as I was, and he owed me some money. So one day I decided, well, I'm going to go collect my $40 or whatever it was that he
for
owed
hanging
me.
Your head out the plane.
Yeah, yeah, for hanging my head out the plane. So I went down to the bar that I was bartending at, and about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and waited for him, I don't know, 5-6 hours. And he never came in. I went home, and my wife was, she was a teacher. She was home, and she said, "You know, where you been?" I said, "Well, I've been trying to get some money. You know, we need money, and this guy owes me money." She goes, "Well, I thought you were going to be home after I get out of work," because she gets out at like 3:30.
Yeah.
And I got like all pissed off at her. I said, "You know, I can't do anything right." And I kicked the dining room table leg.
And, you taught that table a lesson.
I know it. And she said, "Okay." And so, you know, and then, of course, I stormed out all indignant. Right?
Doesn't she know who I am?
So I went and got a couple more beers, felt guilty, went on back home, and I had a note. And the note said, you know, I've left. We're not going to do this anymore, meaning her and my daughter. I've taken my daughter, Christina, and I may or may not be back if you stop drinking. And
hey, no.
That was it. And I had no idea where she went.
Was it a wake-up call for you?
Oh, yeah. I spent that because I'd already lost my son by my first marriage when he was a baby. Now she took my year and a half old daughter and left me, and I knew I was wrong.
Yeah.
And so I spent the next 3 days just about in bed. And I remember I prayed to God and I said, if I can't obviously do this, because I quit often, like first of every month.
I used to quit.
You know, it could never be.
I used to quit every day.
Oh, so you're better than I. It could never. I couldn't do it on like an odd day or anything. No, yeah. It had to be like a Monday. I made bargains with myself all the time. You know, so so she left, and I asked God to take it from me, and I started going to meetings.
How did that transpire? Did you call up the service center? How'd you get to your first meeting?
At the time, there was a telephone book.
Yeah. And oh, yeah.
Looked,
that's how
looked
I got
into
it,
the
too.
Telephone book, and there was a meeting near where I lived.
Okay.
And I started going. I just remember, you know, the smell of the cigarettes and sitting around with all these old timers and thinking, there's no way I belong here.
Do you,
you
remember,
know, how did I get here?
Do you remember your first meeting?
Yes.
Okay. Did you raise your hand and say, I've never been to a meeting before?
Yes.
Wow.
And so did you, when they ran around the room and spoke about the first three steps, did you hear some of your story in there?
I remember thinking, you know, yes, because of my dad. And my dad had talked to me because he had been to meetings by then.
Oh, so that's
how
you
been
were
in
exposed.
And out.
Okay.
And so I had been exposed to it before then. And he had been through rehab and gotten on out. I remember there was this old gentleman sitting across the table, and he had on this hat and flannel shirt and a large guy, and he just scared the crap out of me, and he was the nicest guy in the world.
There it
you
is.
You know, he just had the smile on my face, and he gave me that look as if to say, never, you know, he said something, I can't remember exactly what it was, but he just had this look on his face. It's like, okay, kid, you'll be all right. Don't worry. Just stick with this.
Mm-hmm. Did you leave that first meeting feeling like you wanted to go to another one?
I left that first meeting thinking I had to go to another one because I knew that if I didn't, two things were going to happen. I was going to lose my family and I might lose myself by then. And, you know, there's a quote by Dolly Parton, and I'm not going to get it right, but I'll try.
Close enough.
It says something like, decide who you want to be, then do it on purpose.
Yeah.
And I love that quote. Mm-hmm. And I knew that who I was being wasn't who I wanted to be, not really who I could be. And, you know, my wife said, you know, even if you do stop drinking, I may not be back. So early on, I knew that I wasn't I didn't stop to get her back, because even if she did come back,
it might not work anyway.
It might not work. But I stopped so I could be a better dad and be a better person myself. I wanted to be who I knew I could be.
And so did you know that alcohol was a part of the problem?
Oh, yeah.
And you wanted to feel better, obviously.
Yeah.
That's part of it, right?
Yeah, and it wasn't until, when I say a long time, a long, long, long time afterwards that I realized, you know, everybody talks about trauma and everything nowadays, but I had a lot of trauma when I was growing up. You know, I opened up the door. My father was dragging my mother down the hallway by the hair. He was laying in the kitchen one day in his skivvies and, you know, a white T-shirt with a bottle of ammonia, asking me to pour him a glass and help him commit suicide.
That's some shit to go through
as
a kid. You know? Yeah, that is traumatic.
And, you know, but I didn't get it. You know, I thought that this was
a
childhood, you know?
Well, you know, and you keep drinking and it just never gets taken care of.
No.
You know, we don't emotionally grow or mature at all while we're drinking. So you go to those meetings. Do you start reading the big book? Do you start step work, anything like that?
Yes, I started step work. I was going through the steps, things like that, and I ended up on a swing shift where I was working, and so I wasn't able to go to the same meeting after 5 or 6, 7 weeks, whatever it was. And there was a gentleman, an older guy, one of the older guys, and
old timers.
He was my sponsor at the time, he told me at the time not to pick a sponsor, but he was my sponsor, you know. He was just we'd go out, we'd have coffee, he'd make sure I was okay. I started the swing shifts. I was very lucky. I had a very strong faith at the time.
Mm.
I still do. But So
the second and third steps were, you were good with it.
Oh, yeah.
There was no fight there.
No, there wasn't.
Okay.
The biggest step I had a problem with was, was admitting, you know, to everybody else and telling everybody else, you know, that it was that all the bad stuff
so
I had
five.
Done.
Four or five.
Yeah. Well, that's so daunting for a lot of people, especially if you've never, you know, if you spent your days drinking and not talking about anything emotional or deep or whatever, that's pretty daunting for people.
Is.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's also very cathartic and probably one of the best things you can do for yourself if you're that kind of, you know, alcoholic. It is the start of repair work.
Right.
You know, clean house, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, so I did what I could where I felt that it wouldn't hurt the person. And at first I used that as an excuse not to tell some people, oh, no, it's going to hurt that person. I can't do that.
We know.
So then, you know, but I did what I could. And, I still go back. It's funny with the 12 steps. I don't go to a lot of meetings now, although I go back and I work the 12 steps still. Mm-hmm. You know, I go back and I read the big book, not a lot. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine, I was actually training, because I'm a personal trainer, a couple of years ago. He was an old timer, and he said, "When's the last time you read the big book?" And I said, "Jesus, I don't know, a long time ago." And he goes, "You should just read it again." You know, and so I do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And you probably discover something new about it every time.
Every time.
I do, too. I've read this numerous times, but I've never seen this before.
Right.
I've never put it together like this before. So you work with others.
Yes.
Right? And, yes. And I know that you're working on a project right now that I know is very important to you. Can you talk a little bit about the background of that?
Sure. So I mentioned, I had a son by my first marriage.
Devin. Yep.
And I used to, really short story, I used to get Devin on weekends, right? Mm-hmm. And take him around the block for a walk. And, he was always headstrong, you know, little toddler, if you will. And he would always go to a road. You know, always go near the road. And as parents, you can't have your kids going near the road. Yeah. And so, you know, I'd go get them, bring them back on the sidewalk, and go get them, bring them back on the sidewalk. And this happened, I don't know, 300-400 times going around the the block. And then one day I was listening to some business stuff, and this guy said, "Well, if you want to change, don't concentrate on what you want to change. Concentrate on what you want to happen." And so the next time I took him around the block, I looked at him and said, "Devin, you know, you're a good little boy." "Yeah, Dad, I'm a good little boy."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, good little boy, stay on the sidewalk." And he just looked at me and he said, "We're going to go around the block and, you know, you want to stay on the sidewalk." Because all he was hearing is, "Don't go near the road, don't go near the road,
right.
You get hurt." So it was road.
So instead of living in the problem, you want to live in the solution.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he was like, road. And that's what he was hearing. So that's what he gravitated to. As soon as I said sidewalk a bunch of times, he was like, okay, never had a problem the whole time around.
Yeah.
So Devin, but he was always, he grew up, he would come visit me every other weekend. My wife, Barb, I was very blessed. She came back with my daughter, and we had another son, Caleb. And so he would come see us and, you know, welcomed into our family. They worshiped him. Mm. He was a football player, lacrosse player, played a little bit of baseball, and a drummer, you know, he was a big drummer. So, anyway, he, was growing up, and when he got into middle school, he was 6 foot in middle school. He was a big kid. He was on the line in football.
Yeah.
And, he met a girl who, did not come from a nice household, let's say. And so he was the type that he had an article. It was like, let's fix this girl, you know, and I can do that. And so at the time, he got a little bit too much for his mother, so she sent him to me. And so that happened a couple of times where he would come live with me. He would do well, he'd start behaving better. So he felt like he wanted to go back home. He lived in a town out, you know, not near us, about 40 miles away. And so, because that's where his life was. It's
sure.
where his girlfriend was.
Right.
And I didn't blame him. So finally, about the third time this happened, I said, it's too much of a disruption to the family, and it's not good for him to keep going back and forth. So she agreed that I would take custody. He was 15 at the time.
Okay.
And and he went about 6'1", 6'2", and he was just a big kid. He did not look 15. And so he came, and he walked into the house, and I had caught him with pot before, and being the dad that I am, we sent him to counseling. We had we tried talking to him. I did the tough love thing, got some stories from that, but some good stories and some bad stories. And he walked into the house the last time, and he said, "Dad, I love you, and I love Barb, my wife." And he goes, but I have to go take care of my girlfriend, Jessica. She needs me. So as soon as I turn 16, I'm out of here. Because at the time, you could declare yourself independent.
Yeah, you could emancipate yourself. Yeah.
So a week after he turned 16, he was going to be babysitting his brother and sister on a Friday night. We got home from work, and we had a note on the door. It said, "Dad, I love you, but I promise to stay in school and off drugs, but... I've got to go help Jessica. She needs me." And they set up an apartment. And so they had an apartment together for about 2 years. And he helped somebody paint. He couldn't stay in school mm-hmm. because he didn't realize that you couldn't.
Right, you got to work.
You got to work, and you weren't legally allowed to. So he ended up... meeting some people painting who got him. I got a call one day from his girlfriend who knew I did not approve of the situation. And she said, "Mr. Brigham, you got to help Devin. He's on heroin." Mm. He got on heroin. So I called, we got in touch with him. It was before cell phones. And he said, "Hey, look, I just tried it, and I'm not doing it. I promise." And of course, I called his mom, his stepfather, me. We all went up. We found him in this town, and he just swore he wasn't doing it. And at the time, I could tell he was high.
Yeah. Mm.
And we couldn't force him into a car, couldn't force him to do anything. So every time I talked to him after that, and that was in January of that year, it was like, "Hey, let me come get you. Let me help you out. There's no shame. And don't worry about it. We'll just get you better." "Oh, Dad, I tried right. it. I'm not doing it, I swear." So I talked to him last time on his birthday, which was in April, and said, I said, "Let me come get you. It's a birthday present. Let me come get you. I'll bring you over to my house, or bring you on over to our house. We'll have a nice evening and see if we can get some help." And he goes, "Dad, I've told you. I just tried it, and I'm not doing it. I promise. I swear." I said, "Okay, but my hope is you're telling me the truth. My fear is that you're not." And he goes, "Dad, I'm telling you the truth." He overdosed less than a month later.
Mm-hmm.
So he had just turned 18, 3 weeks after he turned 18.
Yeah.
So his what people don't understand, I think, is obviously it was terrible. Number one, I could have never made it if I was still drinking. I wouldn't have made it through that whole time.
There you go.
I had a strong faith, thank goodness, awesome support system with my friends and my wife and my family and everything. But they don't understand how much it affects the family.
Sure.
His brother. Younger brother at the time was 7 or 8, and he came into our bedroom 3 days later and said, I saw Devin in our bedroom, and it was like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Mm.
He was white, and for a year he didn't sleep in his room again. He didn't smile for a year.
Yeah. Now how long ago was this?
It was 2001.
Okay. It wasn't a fentanyl overdose.
It wasn't around it was. They called it a bad batch. And from what I understand, within, I think it was a 35, 40-mile radius of the little town he lived in, 18 people had overdosed.
Mm.
And they had all either been new to heroin or had just been coming back on it. And what I found out after that is he had moved back in with his mom.
Tried to kick it on his own.
And had tried to kick it on his own and went to the doctor, and the doctor thought he had the flu. Mm. Had no idea what he was doing. You know, it was 2001. Didn't know a lot about it. I never knew a lot about heroin.
Right.
I'd never
gotten
in that deep. Yeah.
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 So that happens. You obviously affects your life greatly. And then, so tell us how this project was born.
So my daughter and I, back in 2003, went on a mission trip, and on the way back in a plane, I've always had, I don't want to say I've been really religious, but I've always had a strong faith, if that makes sense. So I actually thought I heard a voice in my head, not one of the regular voices that are there, but this different one that said, this is what I want you to do, because we had been visiting a school for troubled
youth.
Men, youth. Oh. And I wanted to do something right away, and I just couldn't figure out what it was. But at the time, I had two young kids that still needed to grow up. We were going through, obviously, a very bad time. And so I always said, and I still believe now, it was actually God speaking to me. And, of course, you know, that's the old thing. It's always on God's time, not your time.
Sure.
And so 20 years later, I still I knew I was going to do something. And I got laid off from my job. And it was just a few years ago. And, when I was 55 years old, I started working out. And because I never believed in sweating, right? Sweating is not good to me.
And, I resemble that.
So I just I started working out and fell in love with working out. And I discovered how good physical activity was for my sobriety.
Oh God, yes. We were just talking about it.
Was amazing. Yeah. It was amazing. Uh-huh. So you know, I fell in love with it, and so I got certified as a personal trainer at, I don't know, 58 or something like that. And then I found out about an organization. There's a national organization called the Phoenix. And they do a lot of hikes and fitness and all of that. And then there was a place in a local town that had started what they called the Sober Active Recovery organization, that was modeled after the national organization, the Phoenix. And so my wife and I went out there, and it was in Rochester, New York, called Rockovery. And we spent a day out there, fell in love with it, and they were going to come into Syracuse. For different reasons, they decided not to. And so when I got laid off, I looked at my wife and I said, you know, this is what I want to do. I can't go work for a large corporation again. Their priorities are not mine anymore.
Can you tell our listeners this Rockovery? What is it? Is it
okay? So a sober active recovery organization. It's run by people in recovery for people in recovery. So they started out actually just doing hikes. Right around town, and they found out they had more and more people that wanted to join them on their hikes. So they wouldn't go on out, and they wouldn't, it wasn't like going to a meeting or anything like that. They would just go on out, have, be around other people who are going through similar things, talk about their problems sometimes, not talk about their problems.
You meet people that are in the sober community.
Exactly.
And you do it a good activity that's physically active together.
In nature.
Right, right. And so Rockovery, when we were there, they did a HIIT workout, a high-intensity interval training workout. We went upstairs. I went to my first yoga class.
So this is this is an actual building, a facility, right?
Yeah, they were very lucky. They had a woman who donated an old firehouse to them. And so they built their facility right in a firehouse. So it's like, okay, let's do that in Syracuse. Let's bring it to Syracuse. And so I started doing, in my infinite wisdom, I started an organization where people got together at the beginning of COVID. When nobody could get together.
Oh, man.
So, timing's everything.
I have got the best timing.
So this is like a nonprofit then?
Yeah, it's a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We started doing hikes. I've done outdoor workouts. We're looking for a facility right now, and we found one on a we live in Syracuse, on Syracuse's north side on Butternut Street. And it was actually a women's wellness center who opened up at the beginning of COVID. So it's actually made to be a gym. It has a little community space in it. It's perfect for what we need. And
It's new, isn't it?
And it's brand new. The building's brand new.
Yeah.
It's an amazing space. And the local community college actually has the lease on it and is willing to lease it to us because they know what we want to do for less than what they're paying for it.
Mm.
So right now we're having a capital fund drive, and the goal is to have a gym/community center. It's we're going to try to do programs around the 8 dimensions of wellness, which, you know, they could be anywhere from physical to mental to financial, you know.
And this would be free and open to the public?
Yeah, the only prerequisite, and we're taking this from that national organization and Rockcovery, is 48 hours of continuous sobriety.
Okay.
Other than that, we're removing all barriers.
Would this also be a place to have recovery meetings?
Absolutely.
AA, NA?
AA, NA.
There's MA now. I never knew that before. One of our guests
says everywhere.
Marijuana Anonymous.
Oh, really?
I never heard of that.
No. Yeah. Well, it makes sense because it's so strong.
It does.
Now, you know?
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, but there's Refuge Recovery. What is
Refuge Recovery?
They're a Buddhist-based.
Really?
Yeah.
And, I've never heard of that. We're learning things, Brad.
I know.
Look at us learn.
They're an excellent organization. A young woman in town here started. She did a great job. And there's Refuge Recovery. There's something called Smart Recovery.
Yep. We've heard of that recently from somebody that was on our on one of our episodes.
Yeah, that's like a change management. So I'm actually certified in Smart Recovery, too. It's kind of cool. So if you're very cerebral and really don't want to have anything to do with the higher power stuff, or that turns you off, that's another way to do it. You know, there's Celebrate Recovery, Christian-based. There's all sorts of recovery ways. So our philosophy, my philosophy is, I don't care how you get sober. It doesn't really matter to me. It's if it works for you, let's do it. Let's have it. And, you know, I tend to be a very positive person. Mm-hmm. And, it's like...
Well, you know, God knows we need all the recovery we can get.
What is the name of the organization?
Name is Devin's Rec Room.
Devin's Rec Room.
And it's we're located in Syracuse, New York. So you can find it under DEVINS, REC, room.org. And, you know, our website's, it actually, I have a video out there giving a tour of the inside of it, what it looks like now and what we hope
it's
it will
awesome.
Look like.
I've seen it. And, you know, the space is perfect.
How much money do you need to raise to get it off the ground?
Just to turn the key to get in, the gym equipment itself, I was estimating for 2 years now that the gym equipment was going to be $60,000.
Okay.
Because it's expensive.
Sure.
I was wrong. I went on out and did the, actually asked for quotes from 3 different companies. Came to $61,000.
Yeah. You know, that's not an insane amount of money.
No, it's not.
It's really not.
But that's that. Then, you know, because of different things. But just to turn the key, it's going to be about $225,000 just to open the door.
Yeah.
Then it's going to be about $250,000 a year. So it's not that much.
What is the plan to be able to finance it ongoing? Like, let's say you get the initial nut you need.
Mm-hmm.
How will you meet the expenses?
Well, there's grants that we can apply for. There is, personal contributions
mm-hmm.
that I found out from these other organizations I was talking to you about. 85% of their funding comes from personal contributions.
Okay.
And which is amazing.
Yeah.
It's there's right now money from the state and federal agencies has been little going mm-hmm. to recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about it, there's prevention, then there's treatment, and then there's recovery. The opioid settlement money that's coming in, only 3% of it went to recovery last year in New York State. They're going to increase it this year to about 7%. But people are starting to realize that, we're helping them win the battle and getting them sober, but we're not helping them win the war the rest of their lives after that. You know, we say in, you got to change people, places, and things. My thing is where? How? You know, what is there for people to do in recovery? You know, we, I don't know. I just think recovery is fantastic. I love recovery.
Yeah.
It's a great place to be.
Well, we know that alcohol, whatever the substance is, it's just a symptom of what's really going on. So if you don't have any of those tools to deal with what, you know, what caused that, I mean, you're right. You know, they aren't addressing that part after we get done and we get sober. We don't get those tools.
Yeah. So if there's people out there that are interested in getting involved, they can go to the website.
Correct. Yeah, they go to the website. Just shoot me an email. My email is right on there. It's henry@devinsrecroom.org. My personal phone number is on there. You know,
okay.
You won't get an answering machine. You might go to voicemail because I just get so many, as everybody else does, calls. Mm-hmm. When you don't know the number, you don't answer it, and you wait for that voicemail to make sure it's a real person.
Yeah, right?
So, I'll definitely get back to
you. So this idea can be replicated anywhere.
Yeah.
And if there's listeners out there who want to participate, want to give, or want to start something in their own community, or maybe have started something in their own community, contact them.
There's actually four other organizations like ours in upstate New York. They were all grassroots, like we're trying to start this. You have Rockcovery that's in Rochester, New York.
Uh-huh.
In Albany, New York, there's an organization called Hive of Hope. And you can look that up out there. In the Adirondacks in northern New York, there's SARA, which is Sober Active Recovery Adirondacks. They're up there. And if you're down in Southern Tier, there's AIR, Adventures in Recovery. All five of us got together last year. We did a Sober Active Recovery Fest, first Recovery Fest in upstate New York. We had more than 200 people show up, which is awesome.
Nice. So, now, you've got another event coming up, a fundraising event, right?
Yes. In June 9th, we have, it's called Never Walk Alone because, you know, pets are important to a lot of people in recovery, you know, as emotional support animals and things like that. So it's Bring Your Pet. It's going to be at Onondaga Lake in Syracuse, New York, and you can find that on our website, on our Facebook page, all of that. And I don't care what your pet is. You know, if it's a dog, great. If it's a cat, great. If it's a goldfish, you know, bring it. Ferret, it doesn't matter. So
turtle.
Yeah, turtle, doesn't matter. And
may take longer, but you'll still make
whatever
it.
Whatever you got, bring it. All right, so just to be very clear, it's Devins, DevinsRecroom. .org.
Yes,
is where to find the information.
Yep.
Well, Henry, thanks for coming on, and I hope the word gets out.
Well, thank you.
And I hope something comes back as a result of it. And thank you for sharing your story with us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Until next time, I'm Mark.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Henry.
As we wrap up another episode of the Glumlot Podcast, we want to extend our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in today. Navigating the path to recovery from alcohol and other substances is a journey filled with challenges, triumphs, and self-discovery. Remember, we're not affiliated with Alcoholics Anonymous, but we're here to provide a safe space for open conversations about the complexities of recovery. Your stories, courage, and resilience inspire us and our listeners alike. If you or someone you know is on the transformative journey, know that you're not alone. Join us next time as we continue to explore the diverse facets of recovery. Until then, stay strong, stay connected, and remember that each day is a step towards a brighter, sober tomorrow. Thank you for being part of the Glumlot community.